I'm John Krall. Today's No Limits is a treat for lovers of Indiana history. To mark Indiana's year-long bicentennial celebration, we're going to talk with Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon about the most important legal cases, issues, and personalities in the state's history. We'll dive into what was at stake and the impact the decisions made on state law and life. This is a recorded No Limits, so we won't be able to take questions or comments by phone, email, or social media. But we do hope you enjoy this conversation with Chief Justice Rush and Justice Dixon about the most important rulings in Indiana history. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We have a special No Limits today. We are going to be talking about key moments and key cases in Indiana's judicial history. This is part of our ongoing exploration of Indiana's bicentennial. This is a recorded program, so we won't be taking calls or emails or messages via social media. But we do hope you enjoy the conversation because we have two very special guests with us. We have Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon. Welcome to both of you. It's really good to have you here.
Good to be here, John.
Well, this is a vast, we've obviously got 200 years to draw upon here, and there are many ways that we could address this. But I think the best way to start is chronologically. I mean, in the early formation of Indiana's judicial branch and all of that, what were the key moments or key decisions, maybe even key personalities? I mean, who were the forces that helped shape the state from the bench? Chief Justice Rush, I'll start with you.
Well, when you look at the courts, actually, it was set up in the 1816 Constitution, and then the Supreme Court had three justices. They heard the cases down in court in a room probably not much bigger than the room we're in now.
Which is not a large room. This is not a visual medium, I should say. Most living rooms are larger than this.
20, and I actually looked up with the bicentennial this year. I looked at the early cases, the early docket, and it was really interesting. There's a case of a land squatter, a stolen horse, and then there was an indictment for an illegal card game called Lou in Craig's Tavern down in Brownstown. So that was the original docket. And today I just looked at another case called the Sal versus State, because one of the early cases was the defendant was Polly Strong. She was a slave. Mm-hmm. And in the 1816 Constitution, with regard to slavery not being allowed, she actually was fighting to be declared a free woman, and she actually worked at a tavern, and she learned how to read working at the tavern. And so her mother was a slave, and she was born to a slave. So the LaSalle versus State case, the trial court had said, well, you're still this individual's property, but the Supreme Court took the case. It was one of the early cases, and mm-hmm. said, no, she was free. And she had prepared some of the legal papers for the case herself from learning how to read in that. So there's going to be next month, the Supreme Court's going down to Corydon. We're going to hear Justice Dixon's last case in that original Supreme Court room. We are webcasting it live, and we have attorneys and judges going to schools around the state with regard to it. So we'll be in that courtroom. We've got the case set right now. But it's a fascinating piece of history. So the early cases, our cases have changed from the mm-hmm. card game and the squatter and the land. There's a lot that's happened in between, but it is interesting to read those early cases.
What ones do you, Justice Dixon, which cases stand out for you or moments in the early court's history?
You know, the court has been very advanced in its approach on many issues that came to light early, not only the LaSalle case, but one of the proudest accomplishments of Indiana Supreme Court is that we recognized the right of a woman to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that was well in advance of many other states. We had conflicting provisions in our Constitution that said any person, if you're a voter, you could be eligible to practice law. And, of course, women were not eligible to be voters. And the challenge was made, and successfully by the Indiana Supreme Court. I'm not sure of the year. It was the
1893. It was Justice Leonard Hackney. He sits right across from me on the bench. I always give him a little nod when I'm in there.
And sure enough, we became one of the very first states to recognize under our state constitution that the equal privileges and immunities provision entitled women as well as men to practice law.
Get to, I mean, that sounds like there was a somewhat egalitarian spirit to the Indiana's early judicial history and all of that. What accounted for that?
Well, we had two constitutions, and they...
that was my second line of question.
All right. They reflected a little bit different culture at the time. The first one was essentially a reaction to the territorial government of Benjamin Harrison, and the concerns at that time, to the extent that people had time to be concerned about this sort of thing, because they were dealing with survival, had a lot to do with the structure of government. How much power will this new governor have, and how do we govern ourselves? The civil liberties provisions of that first constitution basically were picked up from the Northwest Ordinance, which Congress granted to the territories, particularly to the Northwest Territory, privileges, individual liberty privileges, before the colonists had these very privileges, before the Bill of Rights was adopted. So we have them right here in Indiana. But that fledgling government existed until 1851, and the convention of 1850 and 51. And at that time, the population was, as you pointed out, very much of a populist. They were concerned about excesses of government. There had been a lot of entwining of commercial interests, canal builders, railroads, banks with government functions. A lot of people felt put out of that picture, disenfranchised. And so when that constitution came through, it was very strong to limit the power of government and to make sure that everybody was treated equal. So it was very egalitarian in many aspects. And so that's still the constitution that we have today, is that 1851 constitution.
Chief Justice Rush, in what ways, I mean, the first constitution was 1816, and then 35 years later, which is really about, what, a generation, two yeah. generations, generation and a half later, we do a new constitution. What were the key differences between those constitutions?
Well, I mean, in 1851, when we're looking at the, we wrote a case on this, the Equal Protection and Immunities Clause, mm-hmm. with regard to the language in the 1851. And he actually wrote the majority, and I wrote the dissent with regard to equal protections. So I think there were more rights written into the 1851.
So there were more, there was the equivalent of a Bill of Rights or more protections for the individual?
It was very interesting. The Bill of Rights that was in that 1851 Constitution was very much homespun in many ways. For example, in terms of religious liberty, mm-hmm. we had the federal Constitution with its First Amendment, freedom of religion and the Establishment Clause, and it said nothing more. But when the framers of the 1851 Constitution in Indiana wrote it, they wrote seven separate provisions to make sure that there was a religious liberty in many aspects, ability to testify on oath or by affirmation, a lot of other aspects. They specifically dealt with language that was not in the federal Constitution at all.
James Madison, not the father of the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, but the IU historian, who's just recently published a very fine book on Indiana's history, called Hoosiers, talks about those two constitutions and makes a distinction, says that actually the second one was written less by lawyers than the first one was, and there are places where you can tell that. In what ways, and was that a good thing or a bad thing? Justice Dixon. I'm going to give both of you a crack at that one.
He's taught this. I mean, Justice Dixon has taught law students on the Indiana Constitution. And I have to give him a shout out on this. I consider him one of the utmost Indiana constitutional scholars in the state.
The Madison's work is one that I'm familiar with slightly. I've looked at it in a cursory fashion, and spoken with Jim on previous occasions. But interesting that he would make that conclusion, because there was a predominant number of lawyers and judges at that Constitutional Convention that were the authors of that 1851 Constitution. But now they were men and women that were. Well, men, actually, at that time.
I was going to say, were there. I missed that one.
It's a habit of mine. They were men that were selected by as delegates from individual areas, and they were responsive to their electorate very much. And they were people of hardworking nature. I mean, this is not an elite aristocracy. These were shop owners that may have become lawyers. They were people who had worked their way through, and they were very sensitive to the needs of the general public. And they were sent there with a purpose, and that purpose was to assure individual rights and to limit the government powers.
And legal training in and of itself was very different at that time, too.
Right. Self-taught.
Yeah. I mean, Lincoln is sort of the exemplar of that. I mean,
we had our first justices. I mean, I always go, whenever I have students in the Supreme Court room, we have pictures of 106 of the 108 justices. And you can go for the first third, and they were all, you could be a justice without going to law school or mm-hmm. going to college.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have a bar exam until the 1930s.
So for the first 115 years of the state's history,
yes, that's right.
There wasn't a bar exam or any sort of professional
Absolutely.
Entrance exam for the profession, which gets to another sort of question when it comes to Indiana history, which I think is one of the fascinating, the period of the Civil War, when Governor Morton pretty much sent the legislature away and ran the state by himself for a 3-year period. How was he able to do that within the confines of the Constitution? Justice Dixon's shaking his head.
It's a question that hasn't come to us, and not one that I've looked at. But I share your amazement. He was a remarkable do it my way leader, wasn't he?
Well, I guess as a historian, where was the court at that point? Admittedly, that was a time of peril that we probably have difficult imagining, you know, in its reality. Chief Justice Rush, presumably.
I'm trying to think of that period of history. Was it still three justices during the Civil War?
By that time there were more, you know, and of course the Constitution allows as many as nine, but as the legislature may decide in Indiana, and we've never gone above five, so five is our number.
You know, there's times in history that you look back, whether it's the U.S. or the federal Constitution, that you ask, well, how was this allowed to occur?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. how did we have Plessy versus Ferguson? I mean, how did this happen? And I think that's just one of those periods of time that you don't know who the structure. I think our Indiana government works because I like to think of us as three equal branches of government, and that we're all there in balance, and it's that balance that makes for a strong state.
Well, and to be fair, in the context of that time, the Civil War period, I mean, Abraham Lincoln had pretty much suspended habeas corpus and other things, and had defied the Supreme Court. I mean, he basically told Chief Justice Taney, you know, I don't have to listen to this. So one might argue that executive power was somewhat running amok at the time, Justice Dixon.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but I think you need to bear in mind that the court can only decide cases that come to it, and our culture today is more litigious than it was at that time. It is not unfrequent for interest groups and people of deep political motivations. I say that with a small p, in terms of ideological mm-hmm. Interest, will bring issues to the court and ask the court to decide these issues. This was not happening in the 1860s and 70s. People were debating and bringing to court the issues when they were aggrieved or hurt or had a conflict. They weren't debating the deeper issues the way litigants today are. So we didn't have the opportunity to look at that at that time.
Well, and we are going to talk about the evolution of the Supreme Court and how it became, you know, in many ways it fulfilled a function for much of its history of being at first a court of first resort and then kind of a glorified appellate court And then eventually evolved into the point where there you are dealing with fundamental principles of law and justice. We are talking here on No Limits today in this special recorded program about Indiana's judicial and legal history. My guests are Chief Justice, Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush, and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon. This is a recorded program, so we are not taking calls, we are not taking emails, and we are not able to take questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter. But we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. We will be back shortly with more conversation with Chief Justice Rush and Justice Dixon. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special No Limits. It's a recorded program in which we are talking with Indiana Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon about the most important legal, judicial cases and moments in Indiana's history. It's part of our ongoing celebration of Indiana's bicentennial. Because this is a recorded program, we cannot take calls, emails, or questions or messages via social media. Well, we've been talking about the early days of Indiana's Supreme Court and its judicial branch, and we've talked about how the court was a much different kind of animal than it is now, that you know, in the early days, there were three justices on the Supreme Court, and the kinds of issues that came before it, kinds of cases, were somewhat different, although there were some that obviously had far-reaching implications. We dealt with abolition early in the state's history, equal rights for women, and all of that. What accounted for the transformation in the Indiana Supreme Court? Justice Dixon, what period?
The transformation that I've seen, of course, is that which has occurred during my tenure on the court, which is 30 years ago. When I came to the court, 93% of our cases were criminal cases. And almost all of our time was being resolved in the appeal that a defendant would bring after he was convicted or she was convicted in a trial court. And that was because the Constitution of that time gave to the Indiana Supreme Court the jurisdiction to be the first reviewing court of almost every criminal case, any case that had a sentence more than 10 years. And that put everything on our lap. There was a court of appeals, but it was doing almost all of Indiana's civil cases. And that changed with two amendments in 1998 and 2002 to basically making the Indiana Supreme Court now a much like the federal Supreme Court, a court of discretionary review. We do not take every case that's presented to us because almost every case has already been adjudicated by our Court of Appeals. The citizens have had the right of one appeal. Excluded from that, the primary area is death penalty cases and life without parole. Those cases do come directly to us and bypass the Court of Appeals. So we'd take those.
But also, if a law is declared unconstitutional in the trial court, that's a direct appeal right up to us.
Which is kind of interesting. If a trial court declares a statute constitutional, the loser appeals it to the Court of Appeals. But if the trial court declares it unconstitutional, the loser appeals it directly to the Supreme Court.
What's the reasoning behind that provision? or was there reasoning?
You'd have to look into the mind of the folks before us. Right?
Well, and I guess I should say in the interest of full disclosure, we've had former Chief Justice Randall Shepard on the program before, and he's talked about really how when he became Chief Justice, just how staggering the court's workload was because of this, all of
exactly
those
right.
cases being, and that it almost, we were asking of the people who sat on the bench to come up with really almost superhuman levels of endurance and discretion to get through just the mind-numbing details, and it was very difficult to look at the larger questions of constitutionality and law. Given that this is still a relatively recent change, I'm going to ask each of you, what was the impact of having a court that burdened for much of the state's history? How did that change the state? And then how has it changed the court since those changes have come into place?
And I'll let Justice Dixon go back. What I see is our court right now probably has half criminal, half civil.
Mm-hmm.
So with regard to when you look at the civil docket with complex commercial litigation cases, maybe environmental cases, municipal law, that it's allowed the court to sort of develop their jurisprudence in an area that they didn't have time to get to. If you're wading through all those criminal cases, and a lot of the criminal cases that we see in our trial courts, too, have time frames different. You know, somebody's, you know, either sentenced or sitting in jail waiting for their appeal to come up. So I think the civil docket gets backlogged. So I think we've been able to nuance, establish a civil jurisprudence that has really helped with regard to our litigants coming to court and getting those issues resolved and not sitting around for 6 to 10 years.
Justice Dixon, you've lived on both sides of that divide.
I have, and as we think about it, and we use the word civil courts and civil jurisprudence, your readers or your listeners need to understand that when we use the word civil, we mean basically non-criminal cases,
everything
but the criminal cases. But it's exactly right. When I came to the court, and for the first 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years, most of the cases that required our decision, there was no court of appeals to decide them. And so everyone under that Constitution in 1851 is entitled to an appeal, and that fell to the Supreme Court. But most of those were criminal cases who basically said, the jury got it wrong, I'm not guilty. Look at these facts, look at the evidence again, and rethink what happened. We call those sufficiency of evidence cases. And that occupied most of our time. It also meant that all of the cases which were commercial disputes between people having to do with money, family law disputes, all kinds of areas of what fall in the civil law area, ended up in the Court of Appeals, and they sort of became the final decision maker in those cases. In the last, since the early 2000s, now we've been able to live up to a more full measure of responsibility to take all of the cases, and we do. So you'll look at our docket now, and they will range from the death penalty cases or the multimillion-dollar commercial dispute, but they will also include a family law case about a termination of parental relationship or a custody issue or a driving under the influence case, believe it or not. If it's appropriate, we will take those cases. About 1,000 requests come in a year, and we take about 100 of those requests and decide those cases.
So about a 10% acceptance rate.
Yes, it is.
So in terms of how did it change? Listeners don't get this kind of glimpse into your working lives that often. So how did it change the way you did your job, the way you approach the work that you do?
I'm not sure that it really changed the nature of what I do. It changed the subject matter of what I did, and it presented to the court a different type of issue, more complex issues. But the basic principles that we apply as appellate judges, how we interpret statutes, how we interpret constitutions, those same principles applied, whether it was a criminal case or a non-criminal case. It was just with a greater complexity of the nature of the facts of the case that required our attention.
How do you, in terms of, and I'm going to pursue this a little bit, when the Supreme Court has heard a case and you have to arrive at a decision without making reference to a specific case, because I know that there are all sorts of reasons we can't do that. Take me through what the process is like at a human level. I mean, do the five of you sit around a table and ask your questions and advance your arguments? How does that work? I'll start with you, Justice Dixon, but I want to hear Chief Justice Rush's.
In Indiana, it works remarkably well. I have had the pleasure of sitting with four marvelous colleagues, not just the current court, but also the predecessor courts, each one of which were very much interested in being conscientious deciders in the roles that they played. What happens, John, is that the lawyers' papers, we call them briefs, but they're not brief, they're 50 pages long, get submitted to us. We each individually look at those and make a preliminary evaluation on our own part. And then if any of the five of us thinks the case has merit to even discuss it, any one will lead that case to be decided at a full face-to-face conference of the five people. We'll decide it, and we'll then set it, if we wish to, for an oral argument. Of course, it's not really an argument either. It's a discussion. And the court then discusses the case with the lawyers. And then the court comes back in that conference room again and again talks about it, makes another preliminary vote, and by informal means decides who should write the proposed opinion. Then that gets circulated, and we talk back and forth among ourselves until we finally get the final opinion out. But what's most interesting about that process, John, is the tradition that I discovered when I came to the court, and we're still doing it, is that we sit in a routine position, always the same, Chief Justice at the end of the table, the newest justice on the court to the chief's left, and the next newest to that person's left, and on around the table, so that to the Chief Justice's right is the person who's been on the court longest, other than the chief. And our routine is that the newest justice is always the first one to speak. Now, think about that for a minute. That means as in terms of framing the discussion, what are we going to talk about? The first person to speak has an enormous influence in what happens in any small group like that. And for Indiana Supreme Court, the tradition has been the newest member of the court, the person most freshly from the real world, we say, who's been dealing with clients and people, is the one that fashions the way we begin to talk about a case. It's a unique way to talk about a case, and it's worked very well for us.
Chief Justice Rush, what's the difference between being Chief Justice and being a justice? Is that
about 40 hours a week. And just to add to what he's saying, is not having – I hadn't clerked for the court before. I've been on the court for maybe 3.5 years now. And when I got the appointment, I said I'm going to need a couple months to – I really wanted to make sure my trial court, the cases were all caught up, and I wanted to cycle through litigants whose cases. And they kept overnighting me these packets. So I ended up having about my body length. And 2 days in, and I was researching those at night. And I didn't know we voted first. And my very first oral argument was actually the school voucher case that came up. So I loved voting for, you know, I was nervous the first couple times voting first, but then I liked it because you do kind of set the stage for, and I'm a big discusser. Would that be fair to say?
It would be very fair.
I liked discussing the position. So when I became a year and a half into being a justice, I was very fortunate to be appointed Chief Justice. And so I went from voting first to voting last. And it was different. But we sit at that table and we talk, you know, before we even have oral argument, we've discussed the case a couple of times. We have conference on Thursdays, a lot of tradition to what we're doing. We probably have 3 to 4 feet, if you were the papers and briefs, each week. Because a lot of work goes into, is this a case we're going to take? We may have a prisoner, somebody sitting in jail thinking there's been some wrong, that they may write us. And, you know, we've taken some, you know, we read those. So every single case that gets appealed up, you've got five sets of eyes reading everything. And then once we have oral argument, if we set it forward, going into an even deeper level, we all get ready again. And then after oral argument, we recess, and then we talk about that case, and we go around the table and around the table until we see where our majority is.
And even after that, John, we are very collegial and interactive in terms of decision-making. It is not unusual at one of those conferences or even after that first proposed opinion comes out that someone on the court is persuaded that their initial reaction was wrong, and they'll change their position. And we will often interact with each other and make suggestions so that the five of us work very closely together, very much involved. The case is definitely a result of all five minds working on it together.
Because we're concerned with being a court of last resort, it's not just the case in front of us. When we are deciding a case, how is this going to apply? How is this going to affect, you know, decisions that lawyers are making, judges are making, litigants making? So we really kind of press, where's the boundary? This rule that you want us to adopt or do, how is it going to be applied and how broad is it going to be applied? So there's a lot of discussion, and that's why we're there. I remember somebody was applying for the court recently and said, you know, with technology, would it be okay to telecommute? And it's like, we're there. I mean, we are bopping each other's, trying to craft the most solid opinion. And I'm very impressed because there's no, you know, when you maybe redraft a section of somebody's opinion or somebody says, "Have you thought about this?" It's welcomed, and it's a wonderful court with regard to that level of collegiality.
If you're just joining us, we are in this special recorded No Limits. We are talking with Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Justice Brent Dixon about the Supreme Court's history and really Indiana's history, the history of the judicial branch. Because it's a recorded show, we aren't taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. This is the part that I find fascinating, and I hope I'm not testing your patience by the human elements, because we tend to think of a court of law as a lofty intellectual and a lot of the trappings. You know, I mean, it's impossible to walk into the Indiana Supreme Court room and not feel the full power and majesty of the law there. It's designed to intimidate and inspire awe. But these laws have to be interpreted, and, you know, these decisions have to be made by human beings. How important is that relationship of trust and respect among the justices? Justice Dixon.
It's crucial with what we do. And it is perhaps most often put at stress when we are facing the decision whether or not to follow precedent, follow a previous decision that was made by maybe people on the court before we were even there. There's a strong rule that says we should try to adhere to precedent. It's not a binding rule, but it's a strong rule. It's founded in public policy. And that involves us at a personal level, really pouring our hearts out as we grapple with these kinds of issues. What makes the law work? What makes the confidence, the public confidence in the judicial system work? How do we deal with precedent, especially precedent that we think has outlived its day? These are tough calls.
Well, and that's sort of, we made the allusion of Plessy versus Ferguson and the fact that a mindless adherence to precedent can be dangerous. Who else is in the room when those discussions are going on? Is it just the five of you? Are there times when you just...
We have some court staff.
Yeah, but are there times when something is so sensitive or whatever that you just close the doors and say it's only going to be the five of you?
We have had some conversations that are the five of us, but with regard to some, there's a few staff attorneys that can be present because they'll be taking notes because when we decide where we're going to be, they'll take some notes for us so we can look back and see, you know, what were the parameters or what was bothering them. But, you know, with your question, you interpret law, but sometimes there is no law.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that are happening now that we didn't anticipate, and there's also the common law or the law where there isn't a statute or a rule in place, and you've got to, what all do you look at, and how far, what are the ramifications for real people if we decide this?
We are talking about Indiana's, as part of our ongoing bicentennial celebration, we are talking with Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon about key moments, key cases, key personalities even in the history of Indiana Supreme Court and its judicial branch, the impact, because this is a recorded program. We are not able to take calls. We are not able to take emails. We also are not able to take questions or comments via Facebook or Twitter. But we do hope you're enjoying this provocative conversation about the state and its judicial history. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special No Limits. It is part of our ongoing commemoration of Indiana's bicentennial. We're exploring the history of the Indiana Supreme Court and the judicial branch of Indiana's state government. My guests are Indiana State Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Indiana Supreme Court Justice Brent Dixon. This is a recorded program, so we're not going to be taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets. Justice Dixon, we're talking at what is a significant moment both in your life and in the Supreme Court's history, in that you will be leaving the court soon, in the near future. I said when we were at the break that I didn't mean to make you feel old, but you do account for about 15% of the state's history sitting on its highest court. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about your tenure and your experiences on the bench. I'm going to start by asking, what cases did you find the most intellectually stimulating to work with? What were the ones that I thought, oh, yeah, this is why I'm here. This is the stuff I really like to do.
Early on, I became fascinated and a devotee of the Indiana Constitution, which in larger measure had been overlooked, not just in Indiana, but in many states. States had tended to just rely upon federal constitutional jurisprudence, forgetting that each of their own states had their own constitution. Chief Justice Shepard was a forerunner in raising this issue, mm-hmm. and I quickly joined the club, so to speak, became an adjunct professor at both law schools, teaching a course in Indiana constitutional law. And the more I learned about it, the more amazed I was. We're talking about a people in Indiana in 1851 at a time when the federal constitution had no application to them at all. Mm-hmm. The Bill of Rights was only a limitation on federal government. It did mm-hmm. not apply to states. So what they were writing on was whole cloth. They were writing on the rules they wanted to live by for themselves. And those still apply, and we still, unless they have conflict with federal constitution, our obligation is to follow the Indiana Constitution. Those cases became very fascinating to me, and working on those was challenging and interesting, and I treasured that. That was one of my high intellectual stimulation areas.
How did that change the way we approach law? Because you're right, there are differences. You know, for example, Indiana's constitution in an area that get some attention here in the state in terms of, say, gun laws or whatever, doesn't have any of the language that people argued about mm-hmm. in with the U.S. Constitution. There's no reference to the militia, no reference to well-regulated. It pretty much says if you are a Hoosier citizen of Indiana, you have a right to own a gun, and it's not qualified by anything. Some of the religious liberty provisions in the Constitution are actually more expansive than the ones
that is right.
in the U.S. Constitution. So how did we see those changes here in the state as a result of this new focus?
For us, it's pretty simple. We follow the provisions of the Indiana Constitution, and we try to discern what they meant. Indiana has followed and sort of developed, as well as followed, the ideas that in understanding that, we try to understand what was in the minds of the people who wrote those provisions and what was in the mind of the voters who approved it, because mm-hmm. it wasn't just the framers, it was the ratifiers, the average voters, and trying to discern what they intended those provisions to mean. But as Chief Justice Rush pointed out, times have changed, and how do we apply some of those provisions like privilege, like the protections that we have against unreasonable search and seizure when we're dealing in an electronic world? And how does that apply? What are the principles the framers were trying to put in there apply in a world that's totally different, one that they could not imagine at all? It requires a sort of a different way of thinking.
What were the thorniest issues that you had to deal with, the ones that were the most difficult to resolve?
For me, the one that stands out is one that I thought was going to be very simple. It was the Indiana double jeopardy provision.
<That's a good idea. laughs>
And to read that provision in the Indiana Constitution or in the federal Constitution, no person shall be twice subjected to facing the same charges. How does that apply? And when it came down to actually applying it, it became very difficult. And it turned out that it had been a real struggle for courts in Indiana for 100 years before me to try to understand how does this actually apply. So the court maybe took 3 years to work through and wrestle through that case and come up with a decision that now hopefully is kind of provided some guidance on how we interpret that in the future. But that was one of the toughest ones that I handled. And there are several others, but that's one that jumps to the top right away.
And we've mentioned the fact that judges and even Supreme Court justices are human beings. And to be a human being means that through experience you learn new things and revisit. Are there any, and I'm going to ask both of you this one, even though I'm focusing on Justice Dixon, are there any you wished you had a chance to do over? Any that you think, maybe not that you were wrong, but there were nuances that you missed or, you know, different points of emphasis you might have done if you had it to do over with the benefit of hindsight and experience?
I think, John, as a matter of personal discipline and approach, I have carefully tried to avoid doing too much of that sort of thinking because it would bog me down. There would be too many of those that I would say only if, you know, or if only. We tend to, when that case comes to closure, at least I do, it is closed and I put it aside and I go on to the next one. There's too many pending matters that need my attention. I cannot rethink the previous cases, unless they come to us again, and we will. We'll have parties that will say, wait a minute, court, we think you got this wrong. You didn't think about this or that. In that case, we'll think about this or that and decide what to do about it. But unless it comes before us in a case, I don't gratuitously second-guess myself.
Chief Justice Rush.
I mean, I think, yeah, all the time, all the time. I mean, I've been on the court 3.5 years, and I'll go back and read my opinions and think, well, I didn't mean for it to be. People pull up that language. And I always worry when we read, when we're reading just mountains of paperwork. I mean, these are people's fundamental rights. Somebody's sitting in jail. And were they given all the due process that they were? So you are always looking for that, making, you know, worrying that you're going to miss something or some point or there's some injustice that we're not dealing with. But I agree with Justice Dixon that you've got to look at that because you're dealing with so many cases on a period basis, and they affect, you know, for the people that come into court. This is big, mm-hmm. You know, whether it's you think it's a small harm. Sometimes the small harms, it's big to them.
That's
and
right.
You know, thank you for having us on the show because I think people were the third branch, but probably mm-hmm. The least understood branch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important that we have, you know, we don't have the sword or the purse. We have trust. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to have people trust our courts that they're going to have justice being done. So, I mean, when we walk through in that state house every day and we sit around that table, we want to make sure we're not missing. You know, we want to make sure we're doing everything we can with regard to this person or this company's or this entity's issue that has come up before us.
At a human level, is it hard to, I mean, what you're both talking about here is a pretty strenuous form of intellectual discipline. To say, okay, I'm going to look at this. I'm going to look at it as closely as I can, and with as much energy, foresight, and knowledge as I can. And then once I have arrived at a position, I'm going to close the door and move on to the next thing.
But one of the advantages,
a lot of people would have difficulty doing that.
Because we're a group of five, it is very comforting to know that once I close that door, if that opinion is not out the door, the Chief Justice or one of our other colleagues is going to say, but wait a minute, Brent, what about this or that or this or that? So there's a shared knowledge and a shared review that really helps the product be much better than just one person thinking they've got it right and they're not going to think about it anymore. We have the advantage of very bright people looking at our work.
Right, and that happens all the time. You know, have you thought about this? Mm-hmm. Where we'll have a case, maybe the four people were, we're not going to take this case, and one is we're going to take it, and then it's just fascinating. We just had it happen last week, and it was a case that somebody picked up on something, and actually we're going to give Justice Rucker a shout. It was Justice Rucker, and he looked at it, and we thought, you're right. You're right. So it's like, you know, the movie 12 Angry Men. You know, you go from one to going around. So
who's the Henry Fonda character in the card here? And I want to ask this because it does get to the human side of all of this. You've been very, very careful in referring to each other as Justice and Chief Justice and all of that. When you're away from microphones and the doors are closed, I mean, are you on a first name basis? Is that the way it works? Or do you
always
use the title?
That's my preference. My preference is they want to call me Chief, and I want to be called Loretta, but it's first name.
It is. You work with first names and all of that.
Yes, I learned early on that as I came to the court right from private practice, I had not been a judge before, and the title judge, even judge, was sort of a strange thing to get used to. Technically, my title was Associate Justice initially, but I found that all of my colleagues were calling each other judge and not justice. That's because in the 1970 amendment to the Indiana Constitution, they changed the title from judge to justice, and the Supreme Court judges were called judge and not justice prior to that time. What seems to happen is that in public events, we are more sensitive to calling each other judge if we see ourselves in a public situation. If we're in the privacy of the conference room or in each other's chambers, first name basis is not at all unusual.
When you came on to the court, you say you moved straight from private practice into this. What were you thinking in terms of what kind of impact you would want to have, what your legacy might be? Did you have goals set for yourself with this service?
John, I did not, as much as I would think that the current brand of aspiring justices would have, because in 1986, when I came to the court, the function was more an adjudicatory one. It was not programmatic. We were not dealing with the outreach that the court now is dealing with. It was during the 1990s that the court approved its first program for educating lawyers on a continuing basis. It was during that early time that we approved an alternative dispute resolution with mediation and arbitration, these kind of programs. They were not part of our thinking in 1986. It was getting the cases out the door.
Clearing the desk every day.
That is exactly right. And so when I came to the court, I had over 80 cases waiting for my attention when I walked in the door. And so the emphasis was deciding cases. I think that emphasis has changed now quite a bit.
Why did – and I'm going to make this sounds like a fairly simple and maybe naive question, but given that while Indiana Supreme Court justices don't live pauper's existences, you could have made a lot more money in private practice. You're smiling at me, and I know that means you've done the calculations a time or two and in bad moments. What compelled you to serve? At that point, what compelled you to say you want to do this?
It's certainly true for me, and I think for most of my colleagues as well. The love of the law is a powerful motivating force. I came to believe in my first 17 years of law practice that the institution of the law was a wonderful, crucial way that people manage their conflict. They learn to get along with each other. They solve their problems without resorting to street violence and harm. There is an institutionalized way to resolve disputes. I thought it was a wonderful thing. I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to make it better. And so when I came to the court, while I came to be an adjudicator making decisions on cases, there were a lot of cases I thought had been wrongly decided, and I thought if they came up again, I'd like to take another look at them. And I was motivated to try to make the law better than it already was. But I was very, very much committed to it as a very wonderful institution at the time. And I thought there would be no higher achievement than to be able to participate in the legal process as a judge.
Chief Justice Rush, I'm going to ask this question to you because I suspect it would make Justice Dixon uncomfortable answering. What do you think his legacy is going to be, the impact that he has had on not just the state's judicial branch, but the state itself? Tough question, I know, and a sweeping
one. Well, no, it's one I think about particularly now because I'm going to mourn him retiring at the end of next month. But what he's done through his body of work, there's two different elements. One is his body of work with regard to the majority opinions he's written on it. You are very humble because I'm thinking of like Fraley versus Minger, establishing property rights in Indiana, Meredith versus Penn. I mean, so many cases have given clarity to things we don't take for granted. You know, when he talks about the extra protections that are in our Indiana Constitution with regard to criminal defendants and your rights, your core liberty rights, and when, you know, your due process rights, when are they protected and not? So his body of work is so large. He's written, you were at 884. What are you at right now?
I don't know.
He's
you stopped counting a while ago.
Well, I mean, my last count, which was about a month ago, he was about 2 months ago, it was 884 opinions, really defining all these aspects. And the other side is the administrative arm of the court. He truly cares about Hoosiers and those that don't have a voice. He has led Indiana, and we are making a lot of inroads with regard to what's called the pretrial release program, that people are sitting in jail, not convicted of anything, only because they can't afford to bond out. He also is looking at ADR dispute resolutions with regard to people being able to do mediation and getting through the process. He is also very concerned with the increasing number of unrepresented litigants. In every type of case, including small claims, we're at like 68% of people are going to courts without an attorney. And the path to truth and justice can be very hard for that. So he started and has led, and I'm hoping that when he retires, he will continue to help lead. I keep talking to him about this with regard to having attorneys volunteer to help those unrepresented in court. So the body of work, the administrative, and then one of the biggest things is the model he is. As a Supreme Court justice to the 18,900 attorneys we have, 600 trial court judges, he models civility and collegiality. These people come to court and it's a dispute and there's a lot on the line. And I actually got to see him try cases when he was attorney in Lafayette. That same demeanor he had is what he projects. And there are countless attorneys and lawyers that tell me that he has been their role model for civility, and he has heightened the reputation of the legal profession in Indiana.
One word for each of you. There have only been, a little more than 100 Supreme Court justices in the state. One word. What does it feel like to be one of them? Can you give me one word to describe
humbling.
It?
Humbling.
Oh, I was going to say humbling. Should have let you go first. It really is humbling.
Well, I would like to thank both of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Chief Justice Loretta Rush and Justice Brent Dixon, for a fascinating conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.